Hello and welcome to a podcast about murder. I'm Freya, and as usual, I'm here with Jem to talk about some true crime with you for the final time this season. This is episode 6. Jem, are you ready to talk about some murders today?
I am. I'm really intrigued by this case. I don't know much about it, but the little I do know is tantalizing.
Cool. Today we are heading all the way out to Japan for our case, and that is all the way out to Kobe, Japan, also known for sharing a name with high-end beef, of course. But in this case, it's the setting for the Kobe child murders, a case that shocked the nation in 1997 and would continue to be infamous for years afterwards. I didn't know anything about this case before I started researching it for this episode, and sometimes that's some of the most, I don't know if I can say fun, but it's one of the most enriching or interesting experiences I get from making this podcast, is like finding out about something as I'm writing my notes, reading articles, looking for anything I can find on this one thing, and finding out more and more as I go along. So this was a really interesting one for me.
Yeah, I think also when you are, it's like a different culture, there's that element too that's also fascinating to sort of get glimpses of in relation to these cases.
Definitely. And I don't want to give too much away because I think it'll be more engrossing if you don't know this case already to find out the details more gradually. But I will say as a warning that it does contain violence where the victims are children. So just mentioning that as a warning. But it concerns one of the phenomena that interests me most in true crime, something we've gone over just once or twice in cases before this, so we'll explore that later. We'll start the story in 1995, the year of my birth, when an earthquake known as the... I didn't cause it, but...
Your mum giving birth caused an earthquake.
Literally. Known as the Great Hanshin Earthquake or Kobe Earthquake, ripped through the south of the Hyogo Prefecture, Japan, including the prefecture's largest city, Kobe. I just want to mention that I'm obviously not that well versed in Japanese, so if I mispronounce anything in this episode, I'm sorry about that, but it's probably going to happen at some point. But I'm going to try my best. I did try and look up how some of these things were said, but there's not always a straight answer, so... The earthquake measured 7.3 on the Richter scale, which is a pretty heavy-duty earthquake. The scale goes from 1 to 9, so 7.3 is...
I thought it went all the way to 10, so I was like, that's already quite high, but yeah. Out of 9.
The epicenter of the earthquake was just 20 kilometers from Kobe city center, so the city of 1.5 million was hit by the most devastating tremors, causing enormous damage. Nearly 400,000 buildings were destroyed beyond repair, and over 6,000 people, about 4,600 of them from Kobe, died in the disaster. Hundreds of children lost a parent, with 68 of those children left orphans. The colossal damage to the region caused not only literal damage to people, property, transport, and power lines, but to Japan's stock markets. Damage was estimated at $100 billion in dollars.
Jesus.
So that's like a massive amount of damage. A whole bank even collapsed as a result of this. And a bank collapsing is quite a huge thing because obviously all the money in that bank is, you know, done for now. The earthquake was no joke, as you can probably gather. And it had a profound effect on the survivors, especially in Kobe, where the majority of the damage had taken place. It took years for the area to recover from the quake and rebuild. It would be 1998, 3 years later, before all the debris had been completely removed. So there was still like debris from this earthquake for like 3 years after it happened.
It's
it took them that long to clean everything up.
To me, how like Japan just seems particularly susceptible to these kind of disasters.
Yeah, I think it's where they are in, they're really close to some lines. I can't remember what the lines are called. What are they called?
Oh.
What are the lines called where the earth...
Like the tectonic plates.
Tectonic plates.
I don't know what the lines
are called. Fault lines or something.
I was going to say ley lines, but it's not that.
It's, they're close to one of the bad lines, I think. And that's what causes them to have like tsunamis and earthquakes quite often. So in 1997, where our case takes place in Kobe, people were still healing after this disaster. Kobe is regenerating. Lots had been rebuilt and the economy was recovering, but the shock of losing so much and having to rebuild their homes and their lives was still fresh for the residents. So it's the spring of 1997. That's just a little bit of context for you about what the area was going through and what the people were going through, because I think it has some importance.
I feel like there are quite a few cases where, like, the general social situation plays a huge role, an individual just completely snapping. Like with the Led Away, the first episode of last season,
yeah, the James Bolger case,
or like we often have a lot of wartime stories where just like the trauma that these individuals have gone through as a part of society has contributed to their sort of acts later in life.
Mm. Between February and March, a mysterious assailant begins attacking young girls with a hammer in at least 3 separate incidents. The girls are able to escape relatively unharmed, but on March 16th, a 10-year-old girl called Ayaka Yamashita sadly becomes this killer's first victim. Ayaka was set upon with both a hammer and a knife in a frenzied attack that left her fighting for her life in a hospital before succumbing to the attack about a week later, according to reports. Just 1 hour after the attack on Ayaka, the killer struck again nearby, stabbing a 9-year-old girl who narrowly survived after being rushed to hospital. Mutilated animals also began to turn up around the local area. So, pretty frightening stuff.
I mean, it's the fact of, like, just imagining someone popping out and attacking you with a hammer is just a terrifying image.
Totally. If you're 9 as well, like, what the hell?
Yeah.
And you're, like, walking to school on your own or something. On the 27th of May, before students at the Tayunahata Elementary School began arriving for classes, the severed and mutilated head of Jun Hass, an 11-year-old pupil with special educational needs, was discovered in front of the school gates. Jun had been missing for several days before his head was found. It was clearly left intentionally for the public and the young students of the school to find in the morning. Jun Hass's head had a note stuffed in its mouth, which read, "This is the beginning of the game. Try to stop me if you can, you stupid police. I desperately want to see people die. It is a thrill for me to commit murder. A bloody judgment is needed for my years of great bitterness." It was signed with the name Sakakibara. The note also had some misspelled English on it, which was the words "school killer," but the word "school" was spelled S-H-O-O-L-L, like shool. But it was clear that that was the phrase that was attempted.
All off the bat, this is just like so crazy. Like from the get-go.
It's very
this
dramatic.
Is like a film.
This right, exactly.
Like, I don't picture this happening in real life, in the 90s especially. Like,
exactly.
Jack the Ripper is a very sort of like fantastic serial killer. But I feel like back in the day that was just like, you could have that element to it, but this is just like mad.
It's over the top.
Yeah.
It's unnecessary levels of like theatrics. Police discovered Jin's body lying on a hill near the school. Examination of the body and the head revealed that the head had been severed with a handsaw, and the further mutilations post-mortem included gouging out of the eyes and the slitting of the mouth from ear to ear. So obviously this is a deeply disturbed individual that we're dealing with here. To commit such heavy, intense mutilation. On June 6, a local newspaper called Kobe Shinbun received a letter from the killer, who named himself fully as Saito Sakakibara. He claimed responsibility for the killing and warned that he would kill again. The name Saito Sakakibara, or in Japanese ordering, Sakakibara Saito, is a 6-character name which, according to what I read, uses the characters for alcohol, devil, rose, saint, and fight. So that's the...
I love it. I love it. It's so like linguistic, like drama.
So dramatic. Another envelope soon arrived containing a more extensive 3-page, 1,400-word letter. The letter began as the note in Jun's mouth had done, referring to the beginning of a game. In the letter, the killer revealed he was acting out of revenge against Japan's education system, which is known to be quite regimented and a little intense, I think that's fair to say.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say.
Yeah.
The same, it's just like all of these killers, whenever they're like, no, no, but you understand it's like a social protest against this. And it's like, right, how does killing the victims of this issue benefit your cause?
Yeah. Mm. He also claimed that he had been bullied and so on. A short excerpt reads as follows. This is the translation. "I am putting my life at stake for the sake of this game. If I'm caught, I'll probably be hanged. Police should be angrier and more tenacious in pursuing me. It's only when I kill that I am liberated from the constant hatred that I suffer and that I am able to attain peace. It is only when I give pain to people that I can ease my own pain." So I guess you would say this is a very, like, a person that's suffering a lot, but also it's very, like, he's obviously very self-absorbed. Like, everything's about him, how he's feeling. I'm only doing this because I'm hurting so much. It's very dramatic.
Yeah.
And over the top.
It's like clearly someone seeking attention.
Yeah. As opposed to, like, it seems silly to say, but it's like as opposed to a killer who is trying to hide their crimes. This is someone whose crimes are literally just like, look at me.
Yeah.
I'm doing this.
Yeah. He's got a lot of time on his hands, it seems, to be penning these letters and doing all the things he's doing.
The letter was also an explicit threat that more killings were planned, and it taunted the police. The handwriting and writing style of the letters to the Kobe Shinbun newspaper matched the note in Jun Hass's mouth, and additionally contained information about the crime that hadn't been made public. So that's how the police knew that this wasn't a hoax, that this was a real, this was definitely the killer of Jun. The police found themselves reminded a little bit of the Zodiac killer, who was also a prolific letter and note writing killer from the 1960s San Francisco area. He also referred to killing as a game in his letters, the Zodiac. And he enjoyed taunting police and press with threats and cryptic remarks and codes and all things like that. So the Japanese police were reminded of that situation. The public were obviously quite panicked by the news that a killer like this was on the loose and threatening to kill more people, including children.
Is Japan... Because, like, we did Iceland at the beginning of this series, and they were like, we never have murder here. Is Japan in that sort of mindset as well?
Yeah, it's kind of like this was one of those things where they felt like society's breaking down and, like, they don't, like, they're not, you know, it's a big turning point in how they're seeing their culture and themselves. In the media frenzy, the killer was given the misreported name Onibara, meaning Demon's Rose. I guess because Devil and Rose were part of the characters in the name he gave. This apparently infuriated Sakakibara, who wrote another letter to the station who had misreported his name. In this letter, he wrote, "From now on, if you misread my name or spoil my mood, I will kill 3 vegetables a week. Oh, if you God. Think I can only kill children, you are greatly mistaken." Vegetables meaning a disparaging way of referring to disabled people. The killer insisted that he was invisible, had no nationality, and that Sakakibara Saito was not a nickname or a code, but was his actual name. Although, you know, this seemed very unlikely to the police. He again encouraged police to pursue him with more determination and to take him more seriously. So it's the sort of attention again.
Yeah. It's just like... everything about, like, I'm already annoyed by this guy.
Yeah.
The fact that he's so like, no, well, I chose my own, like, cool name, actually. And if you don't refer to me by my cool name, which is my real name, then I'm going to keep killing people. And it's like, I'm sure you were going to do that anyway. Just like, calm down, Edgelord. It's
very immature. So, like, bearing that in mind is quite important. The crime shocked not only Kobe, but the entire nation of Japan, as frightened parents stopped letting their children walk alone to school and Kobe locals organized neighborhood watches. Police set to work tracking down the killer. Over 500 investigators worked the case. They had connected the previous attacks on schoolgirl Ayaka Yamashita and others, and they worked on the basis that they were looking for a serial killer. So in a technical sense, it being two victims now, this is a serial killing case.
Is it? I thought it was three.
Yeah, I think it's two or more.
Hmm.
With a decent gap between them. Actually, that said, the gap between these two might not be large enough, so it might still be spree. Because, like, we talked about Joanna Dennehy.
Yeah, I was
she's considered a spree killer, but many people would call her a serial killer as well. So mass murderer is one location, multiple victims. Spree killer is two or more victims, but at more than one location. But there is no cooling off period between the murders.
Right.
So whether that means that it happened the day after or the week after means that they never got out of the, like, they never cooled down. So they're still in the mindset of killing.
There is that idea of, like, movement, kind of, that's uninterrupted in a spree.
Yeah, whereas a serial killer has to kill and then cool off and then go back to normal and then kill again. So I think that's the difference. But so technically speaking, I think we would say that Sakakibara is on a spree. I think it's about whether, when you catch the person, figuring out whether they ever went back to normal during the period between, and whether they lived their life in a normal sense. So a spree killer would be like hiding out, you know, like constantly in the mindset of killing people. A serial killer would be like, I killed someone, then I go home and I had dinner and then I watched TV and then a week later maybe I killed someone, or a month later. Finally, on June 29th, which is in my opinion pretty quick, the world received the shocking announcement in the press that the police had arrested someone and gathered a confession. Not from a grizzled, grown adult male, as much of the public's hypothetical discussion had centered around, but from a boy who was just 14.
Ooh, 14 is young.
Pretty young. But when you think about the language, the behavior... Mm. It's so teenage. It's like you were saying, like, you used my name wrong. I've got a cool name that I came up with myself, and you better use it or I'm going to kill people. It's such a teenage thing. So in a way, this behavior is so juvenile.
It's very typical of a teenage boy, I guess. But it's also hard to tell, because a lot of serial or like adult killers
are quite
often will have a sort of...
Yeah, I suppose that's true. But I think for the police and for the public, they were really picturing, like, when they pictured a child murderer, they were really thinking some, you know, ugly old pedophile.
Well, 'cause I guess it's...
You know, they were, like, picturing a specific guy, and it was just not what they were expecting at all.
Mm. No, I guess it's, like, very strange to imagine a child killing their peers.
Television networks were interrupted for this announcement in Japan. So, like, you know, it was just broadcast everywhere instantly as soon as it happened. And the audiences were shocked, which is, you know, an understatement. In an interview with NHK Television, the chief city official for the district, Akira Yokoyama, said, "I'm relieved that a suspect has been arrested, but mostly I'm surprised that he is a junior high student." So, you know, even they were like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
The boy in custody couldn't be identified due to Japanese laws protecting juveniles 19 and under. But it was explained that he was a neighbor of 11-year-old Jin.
Oh,
and he had known him in a minor sense, but not like wasn't his friend or anything, but he knew him.
Yeah.
Police revealed that they had brought the boy, who would become known by the legal alias Boy A, to a local police, which is so funny to me because it implies there's a Boy B.
Yeah.
And maybe C. But there isn't. They had brought the boy to the police station to ask him some questions, where he had confessed to strangling and beheading Jin Has and to washing the boy's severed head in a bath to release his soul.
That's peculiar.
To verify the story, the police searched the boy's home, where they found the knife he described using in the crime. They found books about serial killers, and they found a diary. In the diary, Boy A described his early attacks on schoolgirls and the killing of Ayaka Yamashita, so they could connect all of these things quite easily with the diary. He wrote, "I carried out sacred experiments today to confirm how fragile human beings are. I brought the hammer down. When the girl turned to face me, I think I hit her a few times, but I was too excited to remember." So
it's like now we're adding this weird spiritual element.
Yeah.
It's just like everything. Everything you can think of.
The following week, an entry reads, "This morning my mum told me, poor girl, the girl attacked seems to have died." So you've even got the sort of like him find, like he, you know, it just verifies the whole timeline. "There is no sign of me being caught," he wrote.
It's crazy to me that he has a mum. Like,
yeah,
that small detail is like he's a normal boy who's
yeah, it just gives a you a window of like a slight of like this sense of normality that just doesn't really fit with what he's doing. In this entry, he thanks a Shinigami, or a Japanese death spirit, for protecting him. So again, with the sort of spiritual thing where he believes that there's some divine protection going on.
I have to say, my like irritation towards him makes a lot of sense with the fact that he's a teenage boy. Because it is just like, yeah.
Hate them. In the wake of the Great Hanshin earthquake, the 1995 domestic terrorism incident known as the Tokyo Subway Sarin attack, and a number of other unusual incidents of violence and upset in Japan, this grim murder would lead to a fear that the orderliness and security that the Japanese people prided themselves on was disintegrating. So that's what we were sort of touching upon briefly earlier about how it socially and culturally, it's just not fitting with what they think of themselves as. Statistically, yeah. Crime rates were still very low in Japan, and the cities of Japan are and have been for a long time very safe cities compared to, you know, when you look at them on a broad scale. And that wasn't really changing that much. It was that media sort of, it was seeing this made them feel like it wasn't like that anymore. Generational divides were becoming more apparent, and many Japanese adults began to be more fearful and resentful of teenagers. So
that seems like a bit of an extreme reaction.
Well, it's sort of interesting that when I think about Japanese culture, I think of all these things that there's definitely a big difference between the older people and the younger people and how they think about things, and and modern Japan versus the Japan of 60 to 100 years ago. They're so different. It's such a completely different like landscape and world that they live in. So you can see how there would huge like lack of ability to relate between those generations.
I guess because it seems to happen very like suddenly in Japan, and it's very extreme, the different how society changes.
The case would be a strange one due to the laws surrounding juvenile sentencing in Japan. Much like the British case we spoke about last season, the James Bulger killings, which we also just mentioned again earlier, it was generally accepted that a juvenile criminal would be rehabilitated and then released as an adult. That's the vibe in Japan and the vibe in Britain at the time. Murders, much less serial killings by children, were such a rare occurrence that this didn't really factor into the system. And that's similar in the James Bulger case, where it's like, we have not had any preparation for something like this to ever happen. Yeah. It's just never even been imagined. So it isn't factored into any of the rules. So it was not legally possible for a person under 16 to be held criminally responsible for their actions in both of these cases. In light of what had happened, though, in 2000, Japan actually lowered their age of criminal responsibility to 14 from 16, to the exact age that that boy A was.
But in a way, I would say 14 is a sort of... I mean, I don't think you should consider them an adult by any means. But I do think that's around the age you could sort of move out of childhood-ish.
I don't think it's bad to hold a 14-year-old criminally responsible, but how responsible you hold them,
yeah,
should be very different to how you hold a 34-year-old responsible.
No,
you
know? Definitely.
Like, they're very different situations, but definitely holding them responsible, I think, a teenager is, I think, fair. But
yeah,
looking at it in a different way, a totally different way, I think. Following his trial and conviction, boy A began psychiatric treatment. In 2002, he again admitted the crimes to his mother when she visited him in prison. In 2004, 7 years after the murders, at age 21, he was released provisionally, and a full release was granted for January 1st, 2005. His location and name were a closely guarded secret, but this wouldn't last forever. In fact, rumours of his true identity had been circulated on the internet from the day of his arrest, due to the police remarking that he'd been a neighbour of Jun. So
yeah,
it was fairly easy to figure out, like, that he could have been one of only a small group of people. In 2015, boy A, or Saito Sakakibara, was named as Shinichiro Azuma. He was named in defiance of the law protecting his identity by the Shukan Post magazine. I hope I'm actually allowed to say that. And, like, the Japanese FBI aren't going to turn up at my doorstep like, you said it, you can't say it. But
it's,
I think, because,
like,
it's now technically
personally...
public information, I think.
Yeah.
I didn't leak it first. So,
no, exactly.
And if, you,
I mean,
if anyone
you
looks
found
this
it.
Up, you will find the name if you look it up, what his real name is.
I think you're safe from the Japanese. But also then, boy A could be for his name.
Ah, Azuma. Yeah.
Yeah.
Ah, you're a genius.
But then that wouldn't be a very small move.
No, but I guess A is quite a common letter to have in your name, I guess.
Yeah.
I don't know. Even his general location was revealed as Saitama Prefecture, north of Tokyo, as well as his job, which was as a welder.
Hmm.
The Shukan Post claimed this information was a matter of public concern, and I kind of see where they're coming from in that aspect, but also probably shouldn't have done that anyway. I mean, he was 32, so unless he's got really good at it, there are no severed heads turning up in the local area, so...
No, but also, like... It's like a weird media thing where it's like, no, we're doing it for the good of the public and, like, it's a totally noble cause. And actually it's just like, no, what you've done is potentially triggered this vulnerable individual into, like, killing again. by putting all this, like...
And also it's definitely to sell papers.
Yeah.
In fact, after his original release in 2004... Shinichiro Azuma had written to the parents of both of his murder victims, apologizing for what happened. Ayaka's mother was somewhat accepting, saying that she would consider the apology, which I think is about as gracious as you can be if your child's been murdered.
Yeah, I mean...
To say you'd consider it is pretty open and warm. I don't know that I would be that warm.
Yeah, I guess the only reason it's not a flat-out fuck you is that this is also, like... a child, a teenager, but
yeah, but it would be hard, like, to adult. It would be hard to feel that way, you know, when something
I don't think I'd be able to ever forgive anyone for killing my child. But I think there is a sense of, like, this individual is trying to make amends, and the only thing, like, the best possible response you could give to that, taking into consideration his state, is to be like, I'll consider it. And not just totally write him off, but good on her. That's like a...
Yeah. However, in 2015, the same year that his identity was revealed in the press, the Kobe Child Killer published an autobiography which burned any bridges he had made with the parents of his victims, unfortunately.
Oh, God.
Despite attempts to block the publication by the families of the victims, the book, Zeka, translated as A Song of Desperation, topped bestseller lists and earned Shinichiro Azuma 10 million yen, which is about £73,500.
That's still a decent...
Which is a decent payday,
yeah.
I think. Allowing him the opportunity to essentially profit from his crimes.
Yeah.
The publishers absolved themselves of responsibility, saying the book would be of public benefit. So we're back at this kind of public benefit thing.
Like, this is such a flimsy excuse.
So
it's like, no, it's for the public. Like, I feel like that's also so vague to begin with. Anything can be for the public benefit if you frame it in the right way.
Yeah. It's just passing the buck. In the book, Shinichiro reflected on the murders in detail and wrote of his guilt and regret over them, as well as his early life and the lead up to his violent spree. Although Shinichiro seemed to say that he regretted the crimes, many doubted this due to the way he recounted them, such as saying of Junhas's head, "Let me confess something. I thought the sight was a beauty. I felt like I was born just to see the ethereal beauty of what was in front of my eyes. I thought I could die."
Okay.
He then...
I don't know how to respond to that.
He then hinted at the fact that he had committed a sexual offence with the head. Jun's father was quoted in local media as saying that the book, quote, "completely trampled on our feelings. It is clear that he is not sorry for what he did." And my heart honestly, like, breaks for that guy. Like, I can't imagine the horror. Yeah. Especially after, just, like, having someone try and apologize to you and then write a book where they imply that they, like, had... I didn't even want to go into it, but implying what they've done with your son's head and, like, kind of just reveling in it. I thought was beautiful. All this, like, gross stuff. Like,
that
would just be so horrible.
Incredibly insulting.
Yeah. Between the autobiography and the diary police discovered in his home, we can learn a bit more about the childhood of Shinichiro Azuma, or Saito Sakakibara, Boy A, the Kobe child killer, all these names. He began carrying weapons while he was still in elementary school. Writing in his diary, "I can ease my irritation when I'm holding a survival knife or spinning scissors like a pistol." So he's already like... really,
it's like, it's not funny, but it is like the fact that it's like written from a child's perspective. It's like spinning scissors like a pistol.
Yeah,
it's like
very bizarre. This what he calls irritation soon evolved into animal cruelty, typical of serial killers in youth. These were acts of extreme cruelty. Dash preface that with a warning, I suppose, for animal cruelty. And these ranged from decapitating pigeons, riding over frogs with his bicycle, mutilating cats, and other things like that. Social workers warned Shinichiro's mother that her son was exhibiting disturbing behavior and was mentally unstable. Unfortunately, that didn't lead to anything, that warning. And also,
it's like,
she continued to pile
up
pressure on him academically, which arguably exacerbated his descent into a place that he couldn't come back from.
Yeah. I think it's just like, also, if you've gone to the trouble of warning a parent about a child's behavior
and then you just don't follow up,
you may as well like check up on that child at some point.
Yeah.
Not just be like, well, it's in your hands now. And it's like, well, clearly this person wasn't aware or doesn't care.
And also can't handle it. If it's getting worse, she needs help to deal with this.
Yeah.
So, yeah, someone dropped the ball there for sure. Shinichiro described himself as an incorrigible sexual deviant as a teenager. According to those he knew, he was adept at making friends, but was considered odd. He bragged that he collected the tongues and eyeballs of cats. In his autobiography, he wrote, "When I advanced to junior high school, I had already become bored of killing cats. I gradually found myself fantasizing about how it would feel to murder human beings like me." The way that he says, "like me," I think is really interesting. Because then it brings in an element of self-hate that I think is interesting.
Yeah, there's a lot. There's a lot to unpack here. But there is an element of, like, he's basically trying to understand himself, I feel like.
Yeah. Finally, this building urge led to the attacks on schoolgirls, and it culminated in the murders of Ayaka Yamashita and Junhas. In probably the most bizarre aspect of this of his later sort of fame grab of 2015, shall we call it. The killer created a website about himself. I can't really believe this. Included a biography with his height, weight, and details of his mental state. And most bizarrely, the website apparently included a gallery of strange photoshopped images of a naked man wearing a mask that he claimed were of himself. So things aren't going that well.
Is
anyone watching him? Yeah, I know. Now, there are some people who think this is a wrongful conviction. That is actually a thought. But I don't really understand that, because this to me doesn't seem like a false confession. He doesn't seem to have a problem admitting to this multiple times. He doesn't just admit it when he's in custody. He admits it several times after that. He writes an autobiography. He's got a diary where he's written about it. It's not that he's only made this confession in police custody. The reasons they give for this being a wrongful conviction, I don't really buy any of them, but here they are. Police investigators said that one of the murders was made by a left-handed person. Boy A is right-handed. So, I mean, yeah, that's something, but I don't think it's an exact science when you're talking about handedness.
He could have used his left hand.
There are so many reasons why he could have used his left hand.
They also could have been wrong in their assumption that it was a left-handed attack.
Boy A had bad grades, and yet his confession was complex and contained many elaborate figures of speech and similes. My answer to that is grades don't always correlate with intelligence.
No, definitely not. Like, academic success isn't a sign of intelligence.
I think many would say that it isn't always an exact match, especially for a troubled child or a child with behavioural issues, that they might be a lot smarter than they appear when they sit down in school and do a test.
Yeah.
But they have behavioural issues. But this is another incident of the obsession with formalised education getting in the way a bit here. And I don't think that's just a problem with Japan, but they definitely have this issue.
Yeah. But I feel like this, I don't know what you'd even call it, like this sort of proof that he was wrongfully convicted seems very of that culture in any case, because it's like, no, we so fundamentally believe that this system is like a way of testing one's character and is like a definitive proof of like someone's intelligence. Therefore, it just doesn't match up.
Yeah.
And it doesn't make any sense. And it's like, no, you have to understand that like, there are different contexts in which like a person's ability to express themselves, I think especially in like writing, that can be totally different and biased in an academic setting.
And finally, the reason they give that I think is most telling. They said Boye's confession contained many absurd statements and claims of things that would be impossible for a 14-year-old to do. And yes, we're all going to struggle with something like this happening because it's unusual and it's disturbing for a child to do something like this. But it's not impossible. And I think therein lies the push for this wrongful conviction idea, is that like basically it's too horrible to imagine that this could be real. Therefore, it cannot be real.
Yeah. That basically seems to be the underlying factor.
And earlier at the top of the episode, when I mentioned this is one of those phenomena that particularly interests me, I meant children who kill, because it's such a rare thing and it's quite baffling when it does happen. Much like adult serial killers, there's still so much mystery surrounding what actually drives a person to kill for enjoyment or to fulfill some kind of psychological deficit. But with children, it's especially unsettling and it's much debated by psychologists. Generally, it barely needs to be said, but these people have troubled pasts, childhoods, where violence is what they grow to know. But many times there isn't a particularly troubled background, or you have to ask why some kids will grow up with some of the worst circumstances you can imagine and don't kill other people. One interesting thing that I came across during research was a paper called The Killing of Children by Children as a Symptom of National Crisis: Reactions in Britain and Japan. This was a research paper that drew parallels between the 1997 Kobe child murders and the 1993 murder of James Bolger that we covered in our first episode of last season. The paper describes how the public in both countries, respectively, reacted to the crimes. And it puts forward that these extreme cases are possibly symptomatic of major social issues. It also points out the ways both crimes challenged the justice system's approach to juvenile crime and rehabilitation. I think there are a lot of parallels between those two cases when you look at them in a cultural context as well. Psychologists say that in some cases there are no signs at all that a child will commit a crime like this or go on to commit a crime like this in adulthood, but more often there are signs, but they're going unnoticed by people in the person or the child's life. And in this case, there were definitely signs. There were signs everywhere. It was all over the shop. It wasn't like oh shit, I can't believe this has happened. It was like, if you were literally watching this kid for like one day, you would have seen that some serious fucking shit was going down.
Well, it's like, I don't feel like he's trying to hide it.
He's like just mutilating animals and like openly talking about collecting tongues and shit like that. Like this
and like carrying knives on him.
Weapons. Yeah, this isn't like normal behavior that you would be like, oh, I had no idea. You know, this is crazy. So
he seemed like such a normal boy.
Right. But it just seems like there was no one paying attention. There was no one there to see them. Like the mom probably didn't want to see those things, just wanted to ignore them. And as a result, there's no opportunity for intervention to prevent these other children from dying and to prevent this child from going down this path. Because in a sense, you know, he's a victim of not being helped and not being stopped. And
it's also so, like we were saying earlier, that it's very obviously like he wants attention.
Yeah.
And I feel like if someone had just given him some attention as a child,
totally,
then this could have been prevented.
All of the behavior from the start is actually about getting attention. If it wasn't, he would have hidden these things better, but it's just people didn't want to see the reality. Whether he could be stopped is another question, but there was no opportunity to try. And that's obviously the saddest thing, I think.
But it's like, what's his mum doing at this point?
Where is anyone? Like, where are all these people?
But then, I don't know, I get the sense that maybe she's a single mum.
I was just going to say that. I was just going to say, like, his dad is never mentioned, only his mum. So that makes me feel like maybe she's working a lot. She has to support a child. She's maybe putting a lot of pressure on him, but maybe not thinking about the fact that she is, because she's got a lot of stuff on her mind.
Yeah. And also maybe it's like you need to do well in school so that you can like provide for yourself and go out in the world.
So that's it for the case of the Kobe child murders. And that's our last episode of this season. So definitely hope that you enjoyed the season. I enjoyed the season.
I think it's been a fun season. It's been nice doing these again.
Yeah. Thank you for listening to the season and to a podcast about murder in general. Don't forget to follow us on social media, Instagram at A Podcast About Murder, Twitter at About Murder, Facebook at A Podcast About Murder with no E, and on YouTube you can search channels for A Podcast About Murder. Sadly, I've written, we look forward to having you with us again same time next week. So yeah, don't know when we'll be back, but we'll make it sooner. I think the last gap was like 7 months, so let's make it less.
Yeah. Well, I know for me personally, I won't be able to do anything before my exams.
Mm.
But hopefully after that, over the winter break.
Yeah. We've had a request, which is pretty cool. So taking a look into that. And if there are any other requests for next season, do give us a shout on social media. You can even send us an email. The email is podcastaboutmurder@outlook.com. All right. See you when we see you.
When we see you.
Oh my God, we had the same idea.
Oh, happy holidays.
Yes.
I guess.
Happy holidays. Enjoy whatever it is that you celebrate. And we'll be with you in spirit.